Now, it's really great to be speaking with none other than the wonderful Chas Hodges. Thanks so much for being on the show now.
Well, thank you very much, Suzanne.
Now, every time I go to one of your gigs, I have just the most fantastic time. I've had the pleasure of seeing you with Chas and his band on several occasions, and you're always just brilliant. Now, I can't help singing along to the Chas and Dave classics, of course, but I do love the rock and roll songs you do. But then fans will know that is your background. What was it about rock and roll that excited you?
Well, I was born right in the period. I was a young teenager when rock and roll came to light. So I was just at the right time to learn it. It just sort of, it never leaves me. When it came out, it was so different to whatever else was going on. We had like Doris Day and Frankie Vaughan and all these crooners, and suddenly out of the blue came Little Richard and Jerry, all these wild men. And it was just so exciting, and it stays with me to this day. So I always put a bit of rock and roll into the act.
Yeah, it's absolutely fantastic. I mean, one of your first paying gigs was Summer Season at Butlin's Filey with Billy Gray and the Stormers in 1960.
That's right.
And, of course, the following year, the same band minus Billy Gray became the Outlaws with new singer Mike Berry. How did it feel starting with that band?
That was absolutely fantastic, because that was when I left school, I briefly had a job, but I didn't like getting up in the morning, and I was playing in the evening. I bought a bass guitar in 1959 when I was 16, and I found I was in demand with all the bands, and before I knew what, I was earning my living playing music, and I thought, well, this is the life for me, so that's what I'm still doing now. But yeah, in those early days, it was great, just being, we were like pioneers of the electronic music on stage. It was pretty new then, so it was a great period. We were discovering things and having fun and earning money along the way.
Yeah, you couldn't ask for better, really, could you?
No, you can't.
I mean, in 1963, you went on tour in Britain and Europe as the bass player for Jerry Lee Lewis.
You're dead right.
I mean, that must have been such a great moment. Did you ever wish you could join him at that point on the piano?
Oh, most definitely. I had a skiffle group when I was 14, and playing the guitar, I was influenced by Lonnie Donegan. Mm-hmm. And my mum always wanted me to learn to play the piano, but I wasn't particularly interested until I saw Jerry Lee Lewis when I was 14 in my hometown. He came over briefly. He got sent back because there was the scandal of the 13-year-old child bride and all that. Mm-hmm. I was just interested in his music, and his music absolutely blew me away. So I was determined to make contact with Jerry Lee, and in 63... we found out, I was at a band on the go, the Outlaws, and we found out that Jerry Lee was coming over and needed a band. So we went up to Don Arden's office. Don Arden was an agent in those days. He was Sharon Osbourne's dad, actually. Mm-hmm. And we auditioned for him, and he liked the band, and we got the job back in Jerry Lee, and that's when I started to learn the piano on that tour.
Couldn't have got a better piano lesson teacher, could you, really?
No, you're definitely right, Suzanne.
Fantastic. I mean, it must have been such an experience. And, I mean, what was the best thing you remember about that tour?
It was just, I could not have been with him at a better time, because when he went back home in 58, he couldn't get a gig when he went. But he was the biggest thing when he came over, and because of the scandal of the 13-year-old child bride, he couldn't get a gig back, and he just brought himself back just playing and singing in the little clubs. And in 63, he was absolutely fantastic. He was a great performer, a great piano player, great singer, and I couldn't have been with him at a better time. And yeah, as I say, I always quote that Jerry Lee Lewis taught me the piano, which he did, but he didn't realise he was teaching me the piano. I was just watching him every night and thinking, oh, yeah, that's how he does it. So,
yeah.
And he showed me one or two bits, and I've worked with him a lot of times since, and he's shown respect for me, which is absolutely fantastic when somebody that you idolise when you're a kid ends up giving you compliments. You can't beat it.
Oh, yeah, best feeling in the world, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, oh, it's amazing. I mean, you've also proved yourself in the role of musical director on backing another legend, Gene Vincent. How did you find that particular role?
Yeah, that was, he picked me out when I was with the Outlaws as being the one that, because I used to, I mean, when I was up at Joe Meek's studio, I was the one who would listen to the demos and write down the chords. I just sort of learnt as I went along. It's only because I had a good ear and I could pick things out. And Gene saw that in me, and he gave me that role in the band as well. So that was a great period, being on the road with Gene Vincent. Because Jerry Lee went back at the beginning of the summer in 63, and we were stuck. And I remember Don Arden called us into his office. He said, I know you've had a good time with Gerald. He said, but I've got another artist who needs a band. And I remember thinking at the time, oh, yeah, it's probably some dodgy English bloke who thinks he's Elvis, like they all did. But no, he went Gene Vincent. So we were straight back on the road with Gene. And we've been for about a year, I would say, on the road, and that was a fantastic period as well.
Yeah, sounds absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, it was when you were on tour that you found yourself on the same bill as Cliff Bennett and the Rebel Rousers. I mean, I really loved that song, Got to Get You Into My Life. And, in fact, it inspired my dad to ask my mum out. So,
oh, did it?
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Okay. If it wasn't for that, I wouldn't be here. So thank you very much.
Oh, well, that's lovely, Suzanne.
And I just wondered what version came out first. Was it Cliff Bennett or the Beatles?
No, the Cliff Bennett one was the hit. The Beatles one is the lesser played one. When we were in... I was in Cliff Bennett and the Rebel Rousers, and we were touring with the Beatles in Germany on their last ever European tour. And it was on that tour that Paul called us into the dressing room and said, there's a song on our new LP that ain't even out yet, which we eventually was called Revolver. He said, it'd be a great song for you boys. And he played it to us, and we loved it. And when we got back to England, he took us into Abbey Road and he produced it, and that was Got to Get You Into My Life. And yeah, I think it was number six, I think, in 66.
Fantastic. Yeah, well, I've got to say, it's mine and my dad's favourite version, the Cliff Bennett version. I really love it.
Tell him, give him my regards and tell him, yeah, that was the, it's much more played than the Beatles, which is an achievement in itself.
Absolutely, certainly is. And I mean, you talked about it a little bit earlier, that you worked as a session musician for the legendary producer Joe Meek.
Yeah.
And became practically, you know, literally his house band. Yeah. As bass guitarist. Now, of course, film fans will remember Telstar, which said all about his life. Do you think that's accurately sort of depicted the way you all worked together?
The one or two little, but generalising, Nick Moran, who produced and directed it, he got the feeling right. He interviewed me after he'd written the story. Everybody said, you've got to go and see Chaz, because he was up at Joe Meek's for like a good three, 4 years. Mm-hmm. And he interviewed, and I said, one or two bits wrong. I said, for instance, you've got Clem Cattini as being a member of the Outlaws. He wasn't. He was a member of the Tornadoes. But he said, oh, it's too late to change it now. So, but he interviewed me, and before the film was done, and he got the feeling of the flour bag chucking, when we was on the road, chucking flour bags at Heinz and eggs and all that. He got the feeling great. And Ralph Little played me in it.
Yes.
And I remember when he did the first, he rang me up and he said, hey, Chaz, I've got to see you. So I don't think I've got the accent right. So I rang him and I said, look, we'll meet somewhere. We'll meet in the East End. I said, I know a good pie mash shop. Do you know one? Do you like it? He went, yeah. So we met for pie and mash, me and Ralph, in Acme. And come out, and he was talking just like me.
Perfect. It's amazing what a bit of pie and mash will do.
Exactly, yeah, it's done the trick.
Wonderful. Now, of course, I say Ralph Little played yourself, but you were also in that role in that film, weren't you, as Mr. Brolin.
Yes.
Had you always fancied doing a bit of acting yourself, Chaz?
Well, it's a bit of fun, but I don't think I'd like to be an actor, mainly because I can't stand it. I mean, my wife's an actress.
Mm-hmm.
When she gets a gig, you're there at 6 o'clock in the morning, and I'd hate all that.
Oh,
and
yeah.
sitting there doing nothing in a caravan for like 5 hours, and then they use you for 20 minutes, and then you're back in there, and you come home. You're home. No, I don't think I'd like the hours, especially them early morning things.
Oh, exactly.
But
no,
that bit I did in Telstar was great. I was on and off. He just said, "Oh, that's what you got to do." And it was a bit fun. I just had to overdub some. Could you care, son? Are you making that noise here? Have some noise. You know what I mean? So it was a bit
perfect.
Fun.
Oh, it sounds such fun.
Yeah, it was actually, yeah.
I mean, talking of appearances on the big screen, of course, legions of fans will remember you with affection on the small screen with that iconic advert from John Smith Bitter. I mean, so many musicians hope to be spotted at a pub gig, but... Tell us exactly what happened.
Best advert.
Yeah, what happened with that? How did what happened to you and Dave when you were playing Gucci? Tell us that story.
Well, that that really put us on the map, though, because we were among other gigs, we were doing a gig at the Oxford Arms in London, North London, and we used to get a good following. We used to do it every Thursday night in the early 70s, and a bloke came up after and he went, hey, he said, because we used to do a lot of cover versions and slot our own songs in mm-hmm. every now and again without announcing them, you know, we just do it. Uh-huh. And it was great when people would come up and say, hey, I like that one, I like this one. Yeah. Anyway, this bloke came up and said, I like that Gertrude one you do. He said, where'd you get that? We said, it's one of ours. He said, I work for an advertising agency. We said, we'd like to use it for an advert. So anyway, we gave him the number of our office, and lo and behold, he came up with the idea, and Gertrude became an ad for Courage Best, and it was a big hit. And then we put out Gertrude after the ad came on the television. Mm-hmm. And a story about that, the original Gertrude was really slow on the mm-hmm. album. Gertrude, when the kids are swinging on a gate, like that, right? Uh-huh. Yeah. Anyway, when we did the ad... In those days, probably have now, 28 and a half seconds you had. Exactly, it had to be not 28, not 29, 28 and a half seconds. And we had to keep speeding it up. Oh, is this like 40 seconds? Can you make it faster? And we did. So it was Gucci, when the kids are swinging on a gate. And it was the better for it. It had more life to it. So we re-recorded it and put it out like that. And
the rest
it was
is history.
Our first top 20 hit, yeah.
Fantastic. And of course, I mean, I do love the Jack Russell in that as well. He's genius,
oh, yeah,
isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah. He looks around and does a Gertrude, doesn't he?
He does.
Right.
We love that.
Yeah.
And we're talking a bit earlier about those people that helped define rock and roll. But how did it feel? Did it feel quite liberating to define your own style of music, Rockney, as it was titled on your 1978 album?
Yeah, it was an idea. I got all the bands I'd been in, like Cliff Bennett and that, and I'd been singing in an American accent like everybody did. And then I joined a band, Heads, Hands and Feet, and that was a great experience. We made a couple of albums and toured America. And it was in America, touring, that I was singing, and that's when it gradually struck me. I thought, I don't feel right singing in an American accent in America. Mm. It seems so bad somewhere in England, but in America I thought, I feel a bit of a fraud.
Yeah.
So I started putting some ideas into the act then, and for all that period I'd known Dave about 8 or 9 years by then. We was in different bands, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And cut a long story short, when I came back I was ready to I'd been learning the piano. I thought, now I'm ready to go on piano as my main instrument, and I've got this idea about writing songs about things that I know about and singing in my own accent. Mm-hmm. So I rang Dave up and we went out for a pint, and I put the idea to him. I said, how about me and you getting together? And he was sort of a little bit unsure about the ideas at first. I said, well, look, you know, let's get together and give it a try. Mm. So we did, and as they all say, the rest is history.
It certainly is. It's amazing. And, I mean, you had a champion in DJ Charlie Gillett,
yeah.
I believe. What songs did he give airplay to?
One Thing and Another was first one I wrote, and I started to write that when I was in America. It's just an old London saying. I got it, I've had a bleat enough of it with One Thing and Another, you know, sort mm-hmm. of like a New Orleans sort of backing. And it began to work with these London lyrics with that sort of New Orleans rock and roll backing that I was brought up with.
Yeah.
And the two began to work, and that was like the start of it. That's one of the first ones that he picked up on, Charlie Gillett.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's so unique. Your style is so unique. I mean, out of all the songs, do you have any, I mean, they're all gems, but do you have any particular favourites?
Well, I've got to say, and I remember thinking about this when I was with Heads, Hands and Feet before me and Dave got together. I remember thinking, I love London Cockney songs, but I couldn't think of one song, and I love the funny ones, the Harry Champion ones, and we've done like funny ones like Rabbit and Gertrude.
Yeah.
But I thought there's never been a serious song sung in a Cockney, for the want of a better word, Cockney accent.
Mm.
So I wanted to achieve that, and if I can pick out one, Ain't No Pleasing You,
yeah,
to me,
yeah,
achieve that. I thought, yeah, I've done it now. That's what I set out to
I love
do.
That song.
People listen to it and they go, hey, that's a good song.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
So
I love that.
I achieved that. I think I can't think of a song before that was sung in a Cockney accent that wasn't comical, if you know what I mean. So that's the first one. And then Wish I Could Write a Love Song was another. But Ain't No Pleasing You, I think I'll put it at the top of my list.
Yes, I love that one. I'm looking forward to playing that.
Right, thank you.
Now, of course, you've played on numerous hits, such as Tribute to Buddy Holly with Mike Berry,
yeah,
Johnny Remember Me with John Layton. Yeah. I mean, once again, just loads of gems. Do you have a favourite from that area and why?
Of that period?
Yeah.
Johnny Remember Me, it's got a special because it was number one, and I played bass on it. I was 16, and I played bass on that. The Mike Berry ones, one of the ones that I really did like, and it was a hit, was Don't You Think It's Time. I do that on stage sometimes. Mm-hmm. Hey, baby, where do you think you're mm-hmm. running to?
Yeah.
Hey, baby, don't you think it's time? I think that's a good
one. Oh, it's cracking, isn't it? Yeah.
I
love that. I mean, I understand, I had a guest on the show recently who I believe you know quite well, John Coughlin.
I haven't seen him for years,
And you played together in the band The Rockers.
That's right.
And I believe, actually, you're playing the first Blues Cruise on in August. Are you looking forward to that gig?
Oh, yeah, he's on it, isn't he?
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. I haven't seen him for a long time, so I should look forward to seeing him there, yeah.
Excellent. How did you initially sort of get to know each other?
Through Roy Wood. I mean, I got to know Roy Wood when me and Dave were recording our first album, at Delane Lee at Wembley.
Mm-hmm.
And Roy Wood was in the same studio, and we would just pass, you know, as we were going in, he'd be coming out, and we'd talk, we'd be up in the canteen together and talk rock and roll. We both loved rock and roll.
Yeah.
And it was not long after when that Roy called me up and said, I want to fancy doing a rock and roll thing. Do you want to be on it?
Mm.
So I did. It was me, Phil Linnett, Roy Wood, John, and we went up and did I think it was called The Rockers. We did an A-side and a B-side.
Yeah.
And, it was one of the last 12-inch singles that come out. So, yeah, that was a great time doing that.
Yeah, I bet. Sounds great fun.
It was.
I mean, John told me he remembered getting a drum set when he was about 5 years old. When did you first decide to on playing the guitar, and when did you make the transfer to piano?
Well, the guitar, my mum, as I said, she was a great piano player. She brought us kids up playing the piano. My dad died when I was three, so piano is a big part of my life. Apart from the enjoyment of it, it helped to feed us. Well, virtually did feed us with my mum playing the piano.
Yeah.
But I wasn't particularly interested in piano, which I know my mum was disappointed, but I remember listening to a record one day, and it was Lonnie Donegan, Bring a Little Water, Sylvie, I Want to Bring a Little Water Now.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to my mum, he's playing the guitar. I said, I'd love to learn to play the guitar. So she was so excited. She got hold of a guitar and she learned it before I did to teach it to me. And so that became my instrument, the guitar, and skiffle group and having a great time. And, yeah, it was when I saw Jerry Lee Lewis in 1958, I thought, well, now I've got to learn to play the piano. But I found playing the piano was a little bit harder.
Mm-hmm.
But backtracking, when I went onto that tour with Jerry Lee Lewis, that's when I started to learn the piano. Mm-hmm. And it was right up until all the bands I'd been in, I played a bit of piano, like Cliff Bennett and Ed's Hands and Feet, but it wasn't my number one instrument.
Because
when me and Dave got together, I decided to let Dave take over on bass, and piano would be my number one instrument. So it's like virtually from 1973, I would guess, that piano was the number one instrument for me.
It's like a match made in heaven, you and Dave, on you on the piano and him on the guitar, isn't it? It's great.
It worked almost from the off.
Yeah, exactly. We're just going to return to skiffle in just a moment, but we've been talking about your multi-talented skills, and that's now extended to writing. Now, I've seen some allotments in my time, but few you could call rock and roll, but you've written a book entitled Chaz's Rock and Roll Allotments. What made you put pen to paper?
Well, that's right. I'll start at the beginning as far as my authorship is concerned. Years ago, there was a bloke who'd written Eric Clapton's book, Ghostwritten, and he said, I'd like to do a Chaz and Dave one. John Pigeon, his name was. So we had a meeting with him, me and Dave, and he said, well, look, he said, just write down anything you can think of, he said, and get it to me, and we'll go from there, both of you. So I got myself a school notebook and started scribbling in dressing rooms, and before I knew it, I was filling up 3, 4, 5 books of it. And Dave said to me after about a month, he said, how are you getting on with that, thinking of like your memoirs and that? I said, well, I can't stop. But he said, I started at the top of the page, but when I was born, he said, I'm at the bottom of the page to present day. I can't think of nothing. So he said, I can't do it. So I got in touch with this John Pigeon, and I said, look, I said, I've got all these memories written down. I said, I'll send them to you. I said, but Dave's stuck. He said, well, what we can do, he said, we could do a Chaz before Dave, like, what you did before Dave. So I said, yeah, all right. So I sent it to him, and I thought no more of it. And this was a real surprise to me. I never dreamed this. He rang me up, and he went, right, he said, I've got all your notes. He said, you don't need me. I said, what? I said, but you're a proper author. I said, I'm a singer and a piano player and that, I said, I don't write. He said, no, he said, the way you write, it's like you're talking. He said, that's perfect.
Yeah, that's so, the best way to write, isn't it?
So he gave me the confidence. I really didn't think of it before then. So he said, you go ahead and write it. So I did, and I finished the Chaz before Dave.
Yeah.
Then I did the Chaz and Dave story. Publisher asked me to do that about 3 months ago. And when I finished the whole thing, as I did the second half, I got myself a word processor, which was absolutely fantastic, after losing 200 or 300 words here and there, like
yes,
you do.
Yes.
But it was just so much quicker. I enjoyed the feeling of writing, and I thought, I've got to write another book. And it suddenly dawned on me that I'd been growing my own stuff since the early 70s. I thought, well, I've got to write a book. This publisher said, he said, write a book, he said, about that young bloke just got married, wife wants him to grow some stuff, he don't know how to do it.
Yeah.
How can he, the best way of doing it? So that's how I did it, and it's on the shelves now.
Perfect,
it's doing pretty well.
Anyway, it came out last November, didn't it, if I'm right, and you can get it through Amazon.
Yeah, that's right.
Sounds like a bit of a page turner to me. Lots of stories and anecdotes in it as well.
Well, I put everything in, yeah. And I enjoyed doing it. And you can read a few stories, but also it'll teach you how to get started in growing your own veg.
Yeah, sounds a perfect combination.
Yeah.
Now, of course, we've been talking earlier about rock and roll background, but your first band, as you say, was a skiffle band.
Yeah.
And it was called the Horseshoe Skiffle Band.
Right, yeah.
Any reason why it's called Horseshoe?
The band was already formed when I joined. There again, I can remember I'd got myself a banjo from a jumble sale, and I'd learnt to play that and a bit of guitar. And I remember around the local sweet shop round the corner, there was an advert in the window saying, guitar player, banjo player wanted in this skiffle group called the Horseshoes, right? And I remember my mum saying, and I was 13 then, go round and audition for that. And I went, oh, I ain't good enough for that. Yeah. She went, yes, you are.
Good one, mum.
She was dead right. I went round and auditioned for it, and they absolutely thought I was fantastic. And I remember coming home, like, I didn't walk home, I floated home on a cloud, And I got in, mum said, how'd you get on? I said, they want me in the band, she said, I told you.
Mum knows best.
Called the Horseshoes, so that was the reason for that.
Oh, perfect. I mean, has this music always got your feet tapping?
Oh, yeah, definitely, yeah.
Yeah, perfect. I mean, there's many fans of skiffle music, and I believe you're going to be treating audiences to this style of music at G Live in Guildford on the 11th of July, and you're going to be on the same bill as Lonnie Donegan Jr.
Yeah, well, so it's gone a full circle. It was his dad that actually inspired me to want to learn to play an instrument many, many years ago.
It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, isn't it? It's great. So,
yeah.
And it's going really good. And he's great. He just reminds me of his dad so much. He's got that same tone of voice. And he's got a good band as well. So, yeah,
perfect.
It's meant to be.
Yeah, exactly. Is it the first time you've performed together?
We've done a couple of gigs. We did Harlow and we did, I can't remember, we've done two and they've been great. So,
Excellent. It's going to be absolutely brilliant. And I, for one, am very much looking forward to it, Chaz.
All right, my darling.
It's been a real pleasure talking with you today.
Yeah.
And I hope you have a fantastic, I hope you have a fantastic gig. I know you will.
Thank you, darling. Try and get down if you can.
I will. I'm going to be there. Right. I'll see you behind stage after.
Cheers.
And that was Chaz Hodges, who will be appearing with Chaz and his band at G Live in Guildford on the 11th of July. Brooklyn's Radio.